content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey, and this is Sports Illustrated for Kids. I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the July-August issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. And we're going to begin today to who's who in sports, and we're going to go to our second line. And we're going to begin with Alex Palou, IndyCar Series. His height is 5'10". His weight is 154 pounds. He was born April 1st, 1997, hometown Barcelona, Spain. Palou is a three-time IndyCar Series champion and the winner of the 2025 Indy 500. He was the first Spanish driver to ever win the race. Over his career, Paulo has 90 starts, 17 wins, and has finished in the top 10 66 times. In 2023, he clinched the IndyCar Championship with enough points to win before the final race had even begun. Do you know, Indy 500 winners celebrate by drinking milk. The tradition started in 1936 with a bottle of buttermilk. Next, we have Paige Buchers, Dallas Wings guard. Her height is 6 feet. She was born October 20th, 2001, hometown Hopkins, Minnesota. Before beginning the Wings in 2025, the WNBA's number one draft pick led UConn to a record 12th NCAA championship. She became the first player in WNBA history to accumulate at least 60 points and 30 assists through the first five games and scored a career-best 35 points against the Phoenix Mercury in June. Did you know, though, that Buchers is the sixth Husky to be selected first in the WNBA draft? Most recently, Breanna Stewart was drafted by the Seattle Storm in 2016. And finally, we have Kyle Tucker, Chicago Cubs outfielder. His height is 6'4". His weight is 212 pounds. He was born January 17, 1997, hometown Tampa, Florida. Tucker, or King Tuck, is in his first season with the Cubs after a four-player trade with Houston, where he won a World Series in 2022. His 15 home runs, 48 RBIs, 18 stolen bases, and .288 average through 78 games have helped keep the Cubs in playoff contention. Tucker is a 2022 Gold Glove and 2023 Silver Slugger winner. Did you know, though, the Cubs claimed the World Series in 1907 and in 2008? The first team to ever win in consecutive years. What if, pages 18 through 21, what if, but are we being hypocritical by endorsing? One of the nice things about youth sports is that everybody plays. Sure, there are people who will argue that participation trophies are meaningless and a sign that society is in decay, to which we say, bah, humbug. We're old school around here. You play sports as a kid for the joy of playing sports, and everyone should have a chance to experience that as well as all the other emotions that come with competition. Now that we've done speechifying, let's talk about professionals. They're playing to win, not to mention what can often be a hefty paycheck. So if it makes sense that coaches rigorously manage everyone's playing time to give their teams the best chance to succeed. But we are being here hypocritical by endorsing that strategy. I mean, if everyone in kids' games should play, why shouldn't that apply to adults? And think about the fans. Often their favorite players are the ones at the end of the bench. Let's say you love Oklahoma City Thunder forward Jalen Williams. Your parents know this, so they dole out big money for Game 7 of the NBA Finals, giving you a chance to see Jay Will win a title. And what happens? The Thunder win the championship. But Williams doesn't get off the bench. How do we reconcile these two schools of thought? And while we're at it, how do we reward teams who build a solid roster through and through instead of top-loading it with a few megastars and filling out the remaining spots with inexperienced guys who'll never be asked to contribute meaningfully? Allow us to present to you the super play. What if once per game, coaches had to empty their benches and put every single player on the field at the same time? Basketball. As would be the case in most sports, a basketball super play would lead to a pretty hectic, crowded situation. 30 players on a 94-foot floor. So let's up the ante. To induce teams to figure out something that might actually yield a bucket, any scoring on a super play would count triple. Down 8 with 25 seconds left, a super play basket from behind the arc, herein known as a super tray, gives you the lead. That's unlikely to happen, though, which isn't a bad thing. The modern NBA is all about spacing the floor to set up open three-pointers. It's kind of boring, but how can you space the floor when there's literally no space on the floor? No, a team's biggest weapon on a super play would be a really tall player who could outjump everyone else. Your best bet? Chuck the ball towards the rim and let the big guy go get it for a six-pointer. Football. The granddaddy of the super plays. Nearly 100 guys on the field at the same time, just like every bad game of touch football you've had to play in PE class where the teacher didn't feel like trying that day. It would be almost impossible to come up with a big play against 50-some defenders, unless there's a hidden ball trick at play. And we like that. However, with the existence of our triple points rule, coaches would likely be tempted to save the super play for when they're near the goal line, where they could just muscle the ball into the end zone for 18 points. So there would have to be a rule barring the super play use inside the opposing team's 20-yard line. No one wants to see a 100-person tush-push that could last for hours. Hockey. This would be a tricky one, given the existence of backup goaltenders and the small size of the net. Goalies already wear so much gear that they nearly cover the entire goal, opening by themselves. Add another guy to there and in there and nothing gets passed. Also, hockey is already a crowded sport, with guys camping out in front of the net and banging into each other. To fix that, an NHL super play would need to bring some chaos to force things to open up. The solution? The super play lasts for 2 minutes, during which the Zamboni is also on the ice and is driven by the home team's mascot. Golf. Sure, most people think of golf as an individual sport, but let's not forget about the caddies. What if, once per round, the guy toting the clubs had to use one? Most of them are sneaky good players themselves, so it might lead to some exciting moments. At the par 3 competition in the 2018 Masters, Jack Nicklaus had his 15-year-old grandson, GT, caddy for him. Per tradition, Nicklaus let GT take a shot at the ninth hole. The kid knocked in the hole for an ace. Nicklaus, who has won the Masters a record 6 times, said it was the most special moment he'd experienced at the venue. We would have called it super. Soccer. Depending on the competition, we'd be looking at 18 to 23 players on the pitch for each team during a super play. It would work better as a timed event, like in hockey. Set pieces in soccer often see a defending team set up a wall. Now we'd have the possibility of a super wall, a veritable human shield a team could build in front of its goal. And to open up a little more space at the field level during a super play, it would be legal for teams to build their walls upward and for offensive teams to do the same. Let's make the game about aerial domination. Baseball. And here's where the super play loses steam. The problem is that baseball isn't played 9-on-9. It's more or less a series of 9-on-1 confrontations. As a super play would just make those 26-on-1, still the triple result factor would bring some drama. Here's how it'd work. A single would become a triple. A homer would be 3 ones. A triple would mean 9 total bases, as 2 runs plus a runner on first. If nothing else, it will help young fans learn to multiply fractions. But still, it's not a terrible idea. It would mean more players on the field, and the more, the merrier. Get the connection. You've seen all Major League Baseball rolled out alternate jerseys in their City Connect line. But what the heck do they mean? And what teams have connected the best? Boston Red Sox. The Green Monster is Fenway Park's famous left field wall and a true Boston icon. Using the same color and font found in Major League Baseball's oldest active stadium, these jerseys connect to the city's history in a big way. Job well done. Houston Astros. When you share your city with NASA, it's got to be about space travel. This new look from Houston continues to honor space exploration with astronaut white uniforms and orange afterburner socks. Chicago White Sox. For the love of sports, this pinstripe look honors the team's original jerseys and another Chicago's most legendary teams, the Bulls. Black sleeves contribute to the NBA jersey feel in a design that draws from both teams. Pittsburgh Pirates. PGH is a structural word mark meant to honor the city's bridges. It includes a texture drawn from the Roberto Clemente Bridge, which connects downtown Pittsburgh to PNC Park. The black and gold are a Steel City classic. New York Mets. This concrete jungle look includes the city's many subways, in particular the purple number 7 line, which stops at City Field. NYC on the chest and the Queensboro Bridge on the hat? Heavy on connection, but light on good looks. Seattle Mariners. The font is a throwback to Seattle's original team, the Pilots, and the black pants were a staple of the Steelheads, Seattle's Negro League team, and the historic Trident into the mix, and this design is a home run. Arizona Diamondbacks. The Diamondbacks debuted a second look this year, keeping Serpientes in honor of the team's Latinx fan base. Pinstripes like snakeskin and a purple and teal colorway provide a bold statement on baseball in the Southwest. Your city, your team. Think you can do better? Design a uniform that connects to your city in the space above, and have a parent or guardian send it to artgallery@si.com with subject line Alt Jersey. We'll run the coolest designs in our next issue. Flag, you're it. This easy-to-play, ultra-fast game is on the move, and it's introducing players to football at all ages and all levels. Flag football is having a moment. In 2023, it was added to the program for the 2028 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles, and this May, NFL clubs voted unanimously that players would be allowed to participate. To be worthy of a world stage like the Olympics, the sport must be played across 75 countries and 4 continents, men and 40 counties, countries and 3 continents for women. In other words, it needs to demonstrate mass appeal. And flag football is all about appeal. It's easy and accessible to play, requiring only 5 players a side, and a field 50 yards long by 25 yards wide. According to Olympics regulations. But its biggest accessibility factor is the most obvious: no tackling. On the surface, it's a safety issue, but more broadly, the lack of contact in flag football is the main factor behind the sport's growth. Athletes can play at a younger age. The risk for concussion is so low that helmets aren't required, though protective headgear is common. And it has become a big entry point for women and girls to access football at all levels. It's all about speed. Speed, speed, more speed, says Macy Johnsich of the United States Women's National Team. The compressed style of football means plays happen quickly, and the athletes who stand out the most are the ones who can adapt to the pace with fast and creative thinking. Johnsich was one of the hundreds of players who participated in USA Football's Summer Series, a tournament held in Los Angeles in mid-June featuring flag football and flag football teams from 10 countries across all levels. In a final exhibition game against Australia, Johnsich threw for 3 touchdowns in the first half alone, helping her team to a 40-12 win over the players from Down Under. Last year, she was an integral part of the national team's gold medal win at IFAF World Championships in Finland. At 19 years old, Johnsich is the youngest player on the roster. She started playing flag 13 years ago when she saw how much fun her brothers were having. "I played in a boys' league," she says. "There were probably like 10 girls in the whole league." Johnsich was lucky enough to grow up in Nevada, one of 15 states where flag football is a sanctioned varsity high school sport for girls, earning All-Star Game MVP at Coronado High School. She now plays for the University of Florida. But when asked about her goals, her mindset is Olympic. "I want to represent my country," she says, "get as many golds as I can." Opportunities for girls and women in flag football have absolutely exploded over the last few years. USA Football, the governing body for tackle and flag football, offers this statistic. In the 10 years from 2015 through 2024, the number of girls ages 6 to 12 playing flag football has increased 283%, crossing 144,500 participants. More than 267,200 girls ages 6 to 17 played flag in 2024. And for boys, USA Football reports that in that same age range, more than 1.7 million athletes played flag football in 2024. At the top of the sport, there are players like Darnell Doucet, the quarterback for the U.S. men's national team and one of the most well-known flag football players in the world. Team USA has not lost an international tournament since he joined in 2021, and in Los Angeles, Doucet led his team to a 41-13 victory against Australia, completing 80% of his passes. The summer series demonstrated just how popular flag has become, hosting games for players across 8 age divisions, many of them with athletes in elementary school. It also featured both under-15 and under-17 boys and girls national teams representing the top emerging athletes in the sport at the junior level. Many of them will be angling for a place on the Olympic roster come 2028. Laundry Smith, a 16-year-old from Texas, is one such player. Competing in the Junior International Cup during the summer series with the under-17 girls flag national team and winning her 3rd consecutive gold medal. Smith relies heavily on her club team because Texas doesn't offer flag at the varsity level, but she has become a big advocate for sanctioning the sport. "I got the opportunity to speak at one of the UIL meetings, and that was super powerful," she says about her speech to the organization responsible for varsity sports in Texas high schools. "It was important to tell my story and share what the sport has done for me." Smith says the best part of flag is how easy it is to play. "I see girls starting around my age and being really successful. That's my absolute favorite aspect of flag and why I think it creates so many opportunities." Smith has offers to play at a collegiate level for 2 different schools, But like Johnson, her focus is on the biggest door that has opened for flag football. I'm doing all I can to work toward LA 28. Next, page 34 through 37, Tiger King. Picture here of Detroit's Tariq Skubal on page 34. Call him whatever you want, as long as you call him the best pitcher in baseball. Because Detroit A's Tariq Skubal has certainly earned that title. It's not unusual for famous people to get creative when they're giving their name to a worker behind the counter at a coffee shop. If you're a pop star trying to keep a low profile, the last thing you want is for a barista to hold up your drink and yell, "Iced decaf, vanilla latte for Rihanna." Tariq Skubal isn't a pop star. He's the best pitcher in baseball. And he also uses a fake name when he's placing an order or making a restaurant reservation. "I just tell them Jack," he says. It's not because he doesn't want fans to mob him. No, he goes with a different first name because no one can seem to pronounce his real one properly. For the record, it's not Tariq or Tariq or Tariq, it's Tariq, like Derek with a T. At least that's what we called him while working on this article. And photo shoot. And he seemed fine with it. But really, he's fine with pretty much anything. "I stopped caring about it in high school," says the 28-year-old Tigers ace. Back then, Skubal was a pretty good pitcher who had dreams of playing basketball, the sport his dad coached in college. He wasn't especially big, and he played at a small school in Arizona. When it came time to get recruited, though, Skubal was more in demand as a pitcher who could occasionally reach 90 miles an hour than as a 6'3" basketball player. The only Division I scholarship offer he got was to play baseball at Seattle University, which means a whole lot of schools passed on a future Cy Young Award winner. But that's never bothered him. "I was excited to be going Division I," Skubal says. "No one from my hometown really ever went Division I. I was very excited to be able to even play college baseball." But after a promising start to the college career, Skubal encountered something that would become a recurring theme through the years, a health-related bump in the road. During a 2016 game at Chicago State, where the temperature was just above freezing, he threw a pitch and felt his left arm suddenly go dead. He battled through it and tried to make his next start. But within a day, he could barely move his elbow. He had a torn ligament and needed Tommy John surgery. Recuperating from the operation wasn't easy, especially for a kid at a small school in the days before college athletes could earn NIL money. Skubal was living in Kingman, Arizona, and doing his rehab in Phoenix, which was about 3.5 hours away. Every Monday, his girlfriend, Jessica, would make him a week's worth of lunches, and he would make the drive to Phoenix in her car. "Chicken, potatoes, rice," Skubal says. "We'd pack it into those potato salad things you buy at the grocery store." Jessica worked for a company that managed hotel properties, so she could get him a cheap rate at places that offered free breakfast. When Skubal was healthy enough to return to the mound for the Red Hawks, he found something strange was happening. "It was hard to get back in the competition mode," he says. "You spent the last 18 months just rehabbing, and then you expect yourself to be perfect when you go out there. At least I did, and that's not just how the game's played. No one throws the ball exactly where they want to every time." Skubal kept tried to make unhittable pitches instead of just relying on his natural ability. In the 2018 season, his first after the operation, he had 33 walks and 26 strikeouts in his first 25 2/3 innings. Then, as he put it, a switch flipped. he realized he had to change his approach and simply go attack hitters. Over the remaining 54 and one-third innings, he walked just 23 batters while striking out 80. Those numbers caught the attention of the Tigers, who picked Skubal in the ninth round of the 2018 draft. Within 2 years, he was in the majors, and by 2022, he had become a solid starter. Then something familiar happened, an elbow injury. This one to his flexor tendon. Skubal had his second major surgery in August of 2022. This time, when he returned, he knew what to expect from a mental standpoint. And there was an added physical benefit. When you do a full rehab, Skubal says, your body gets into really good shape. Skubal came back from his flexor surgery throwing harder than ever, and since he had mastered the mental aspect of returning from surgery, he wasted no time elevating his game. In September 2023, his third full month back in the majors, he was the AL Pitcher of the Month. His dominance continued into 2024, when he became one of just 22 pitchers in history to win the Triple Crown, leading the league in wins, 18, ERA 2.39, and strikeouts 228. Early on in our careers together, we went through some struggles, says Detroit pitcher Casey Mize, who missed all of 2023 season with an arm injury. And instead of letting them beat him down, he took that as a challenge to get better. And he was. He's grown each of the years in the big leagues, and now he's the best in the game. Skubal has proven that time and time again this year, in his first 17 starts, he had nearly 10 times as many strikeouts, 138, as walked, 14. Against Cleveland on May 25th, he threw a complete game, two-hit shutout with 13 strikeouts. Probably the best game I've ever seen in the big league, says Mize. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sports Illustrated for Kids is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.